I'm not going to engage in that, but Commissioner Carpenter, fellow commissioners, directors, Ron Warren with the director's office. I get the pleasure of introducing the panel this morning. To my immediate left, Kyle Addix, who's the Intergovernmental Salmon Manager in the Fish Program. For without him, I think I'd be lost. He's my right hand. Beyond Phil Anderson, Senior Attorney General Mike Grossman, who is our and has been our legal brain for at least the last 8 years that I've been more heavily involved in fishery management than I had been prior to that. And then I'd like to introduce everybody, just in case folks at the commission table or behind me don't know, but my distinct pleasure to present with past director Phil Anderson. He's also the current chair of the Pacific Fishery Management Council. He's a commissioner on the Pacific Salmon Commission and participates within the International Pacific Halibut Commission, as well as the Pacific States Marine Fishery Commission. Through our development of the Puget Sound Chinook Resource Management Plan, Phil has volunteered his time, drives in from his home out on the coast, and has been a welcome addition to the team. Not like he ever got to leave us, but it's nice to have him back. So thanks for all your efforts, Phil. So we're here today to introduce to you and to the public the Chinook Resource Management Plan for Puget Sound. It's a fairly detailed, extensive document that talks about watersheds and stocks within Puget Sound that we hope to submit soon to NOAA Fisheries to seek coverage under the Endangered Species Act. And on this first slide, we just wanted to put this here. There had been a lot of question about the delegation of authority from the commission to the director. This is a quote from the delegation letter that specifically talks about the delegation given to the director and in specific reference to this particular document within that delegation. So more specifically about the presentation, hope that we really convey to you the dire straits. You heard Director Blackmore yesterday from the Puget Sound Partnership talk about the grave situation we're in within Puget Sound. And it's not just for salmon. For southern resident killer whale, just got the explosion of population that not only we've seen in recent years, but what's predicted to happen within the metropolitan areas of Puget Sound, pretty staggering. And so to understand the high-risk environment, what the Chinook populations and some of the trends look like, as well as what the killer whale situation is. And then we'll also talk about some of the major elements about the plan, as well as talk about our communication plan as we do hand this off. And when I say hand this off, the co-managers of the state of Washington hand this off to NOAA for their review and hopefully their coverage under the Endangered Species Act. So with that, I will turn this over to Phil Anderson.
Thanks very much, Ron, and good morning, commissioners and everyone here. It's a pleasure to be here with you today to participate in presenting our current circumstances surrounding the Puget Sound Resource Management Plan for Chinook Salmon, and to be a part of the presentation that provides you with information relative to the work that the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife has been doing with all of the affected treaty tribes, as well as NOAA fisheries, in addressing this important topic. I'm going to talk a little bit about the operating environment first. There's lots of bad news in the relative to the operating environment, and you've certainly heard about some of that today. I'm also going to provide you with some reasons for optimism and reasons where I think that if we can work together, that we can move from here and look for ways to begin to make things better. So just this first slide is really kind of taking a look back to really demonstrate what has happened in terms of the fishery management and how responsive the Department of Fish and Wildlife, working together with the, their co-managers and the treaty tribes, have been in terms of reducing their exploitation rates on stocks, being innovative in terms of trying to figure out how to maintain fisheries in this challenging environment. The two bullets there talking about those innovations, as well as a depiction of the substantial reductions in fishery, what we call exploitation rates. I'm assuming everyone knows what we're talking about when we talk about exploitation rates. My analogy is if you have a jar full of that has 100 marbles in it, the exploitation rate is the number of marbles you take out of that jar relative to your fishing. So if you have a 10% exploitation rate, you're going to take 10 marbles out of that jar. So just that's my simplistic way of explaining exploitation rates. But it is a key criteria in terms of how we judge what we are doing in terms of our management and our impacts of our fisheries on various stocks. The graphic here is a depiction of the reduction in those exploitation rates. The example here is on the Snohomish Chinook, and you can see there are obviously two lines on here. The blue line is all fisheries. Everybody's aware that we have a lot of interceptions that occur on our stocks that originate in Washington, and particularly in Puget Sound in the north, that being north of the border in Canada, and to a lesser degree for this stock in southeast Alaska. So you can see the dramatic declines that have taken place over time in response to the decline in the abundance of this population. My good friend Pat Patillo and longtime colleague put together some estimates, I assume using WDFW data for some other stocks. There's been over the same period of time, there's been about a 43% reduction in Skagit summer fall, 81% reduction in Skykomish and Mid-Hood Canal, and 57% on Stillaguamish. So the point is here that the co-managers have been very responsive as these stocks have gotten themselves into trouble. On the other side, in terms of the innovation, is the development of marked selective fisheries. And it started originally back, we were dealing with coho. The first marked selective fishery that I remember for coho was in, I believe it was in 1998. It was in the Columbia River recreational fishery. It was expanded to the other ocean areas in 1999. And then from there, it transitioned for using that tool to maintain opportunity to take our hatchery production, in particular, in for Chinook. And probably the watermark year that I remember the most, when I believe we started in 2004, we made a big increase in the number of marked selective fisheries in 2007 through the North Falcon process. So mass marking, creating that tool, being innovative about how to go about detecting those fish that still have coated wire tags, all of that work is gone into the innovation of how to maintain fisheries in an environment with listed populations of Chinook that in some cases are very, very low in number. So just to emphasize, there's been a lot of work done over time to address in fisheries. There's been a lot of reductions in fisheries to address declining populations and at the same time looking for innovative ways to maintain fisheries over time. As Ron mentioned, I've been on the Pacific Salmon Commission since 2010, and I had the opportunity to serve as the U.S. lead negotiator for the update of the treaty and the renegotiations of the chapters, which are relative to each one of the species. My particular role was concentrated on Chinook. But we focused on conservation of what we're calling here Salish Sea Chinook because we have a lot of the Chinook populations in Canada, particularly those that originate in Georgia Strait and the east side of Vancouver Island, which are also and have similar characteristics and showing similar concerns in decline. So that's where we focused our effort. You know, leading the way was our concerns relative to Nooksack and Stillaguamish, which are at very low levels and are intercepted in a fairly significant way in Canadian fisheries, and again, to a lesser degree for these particular stocks in Southeast Alaska, but yet there are some recoveries there. So out of that work, as part of it, part of the result was this 12.5% reduction in Canadian Salish Sea fisheries relative to 2009-15. So we're calculating what we call a calendar year exploitation rate, that average, and then we they are obligated to reduce that from that level by 12.5%. In what we call their ISBM fisheries, their individual stock-based management. So all the stuff, the fisheries in Strait of Juan de Fuca and inside Georgia Strait are a part of that. In addition, we were able to achieve a 12.5% reduction in the west coast of Vancouver Island fishery, which affects both troll and sport. And we had an additional reduction of just over 7%. In Southeast Alaska. Now, those last two, the 12.5% on the west coast of Vancouver Island and 7% Southeast Alaska are abundance-based, so the lower the abundance is when those trigger, there's a graduated in high abundance years, their reductions are less than that value. In order to encourage and have those other entities, particularly Canada, accept reductions on stocks that we had a concern about, we had to do some things here too. In part, we had to ensure them that we were not going to be increasing our exploitation rates in future years as they reduce theirs. So we are held for most stocks in Puget Sound to the average exploitation rate, again, in that 2009 through 2015 time frame. While they're reducing theirs by 12.5%, we're saying we're going to keep ours consistent with that 2009-15 average, and we are calculating that over a three-year average. So as we implement the treaty, it's not going to be a year-by-year. We'll be looking year-by-year, but the judgment as to whether or not we're complying with the treaty will be judged based on a three-year average. The additional piece that I'll touch on just a little bit more later is that as part of this, what we call our non-federal commissioners from the U.S. section, which is myself, Ron Allen, and Doug Vincent Lang, we went about trying to see if we could get Congress to fund the implementation aspects of our new agreement. We had a huge ask in excess of $50 million. I never thought we were going to get all that, and sure enough, we didn't. However, we did get $20 million of additional money in this year's budget to implement the treaty. I suspect that most of that is going to go to actions associated with mitigation. I'll talk about that a little bit more. And I can't say anything with finality about the distribution of those funds until we complete our negotiations with Alaska. We had negotiations here this last week, as late as yesterday morning. We'll continue to work on that. I suspect we'll have that agreement done by our February Pacific Salmon Commission meeting, which is the third week of February. We've talked a lot about, and there's been a lot of terms used to describe where we are in Puget Sound. The State of the Sound report characterized Puget Sound being in grave trouble. Looking at 87% of the indicators not meeting 2020 targets. So things like, where are we with eelgrass? Where are we with contaminants of Chinook salmon? Where are we with numbers of southern resident orca killer whales? Where are we with numbers of wild Chinook salmon? Where are we relative to our herring populations? Those types of are the indicators that I'm referencing there, and none of them are showing a positive result. At the same time, and Chad spoke to this a little bit during his presentation on the Willapa, we've got a marine heat wave that's persisting. It comes and goes, mostly comes. It's present now. Scientists are saying that it's relatively shallow, which could mean it could get dispersed with the right weather conditions without too much trouble. But if you look at the map, there's a lot of hot water around, and it extends up into the Gulf of Alaska, and that's not good for salmon. There was also a slide on the Fraser River called the Big Bar Slide that Commissioner Kehoe is very aware of. It's well up into the interior in British Columbia. However, it's below where about 80% of the Chinook salmon spawn. It's below where a good portion of the sockeye spawn. It's below where a portion of the coho spawn. It represented virtually a total blockage, talking about a rock wall of 400 that was 450 feet high, slid into the river, created a 16-foot fall and water velocities going through that area that there's no way a salmon can get through. So there's Herculean efforts going on right now by Canada, really even as we speak, in a really inhospitable climate in the winter. They've hired a very, very experienced contractor that they're trying to deal with that. But that is, again, an additional thing that's out there. That's concerning. We've got reduced fecundity rates, lower size at age, and our returning fish. And so there's lots of indicators out there that are cause for concern. Southern resident killer whales. I'm co-chairing a group for the Pacific Council looking at and working with NOAA Fisheries in terms of. Along with Kyle and Derek Dapp from WDFW, and we have people from California Department of Fish and Wildlife, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, ourselves, the tribes, NOAA Fisheries, redoing the biological opinion. I think the last one that was done was 2012. They've been sued on the staleness of that biological opinion. So we're in the process of developing a new one. And I think there's a lot to be learned from that process that can be applied to Puget Sound in terms of process about how you go about looking at the data and analyzing the effects of fisheries on the prey base. So it's a real process that's based in science and data and analysis, which I think is exactly what we need to do when we're looking at the effect of fisheries on that population, and avoid some of the knee-jerk reactions and assumptions that are made about fisheries and prey base. Fisheries are going to be scrutinized as tight as they've ever been, however, when it comes to southern resident killer whales. And as these new biological opinions are developed both for the ocean fisheries as well as for Puget Sound, we need to have our act together. And I really applaud the department in particular for Kyle and Derek's work in this regard in this ocean, because, again, I think a lot of that can be beneficial when we're looking at Puget Sound. So I'm going to hand it off to Kyle at this, or no, I'm handing it off to Mike at this point. Is that correct?
I don't know. I'm happy to.
I believe it's your turn according to my script, and then I'll be coming back with you in just a little bit. These are just my slides, buddy.
That's okay. I think there were some. The reason I was looking over Phil's shoulder here to see where he was in slides, but I think there are some. Were there some legal slides, Kyle, that you wanted to put up? I thought I saw.
Oh yes, I do. I apologize.
Awesome. Go ahead.
Yeah, have sympathy for your old man partner here, would you? Okay. I did have one other piece. I had this thing written on this slide that says stop. So remind me not to try to keep going on to the slides later in the presentation. But we'll forget about all that. We want to, I mean, again, back in looking at this operating environment, and there's a lot of ways to look at the data. You know, we have one here that we've showed you in terms of where we are now versus where we were in the 10 years prior to the listing of Puget Sound Chinook. And depending, you can pick a stock, and there are some that are better than others, no question about it. There are places where I think our actions have made a positive difference in terms of an increase in populations. But the fact of the matter is that overall, the aggregate population of wild Puget Sound Chinook salmon has gone down since then, in some cases in a significant way, despite all of the things that we have tried to do to reverse that trend. In addition to all the scrutiny that the fisheries are getting and are going to continue to get, I think reducing predation is an important strategy for us to look at and to test in the short term. I recognize Commissioner Linville's comments about the challenges with that, and it is a huge challenge, whether it's the predation by birds or marine mammals. There are strong-held views on both sides, but in my mind, I think the data pretty clearly shows that if we are not able to do something to reduce the level of predation, all of the actions in the world that we do on the fishery side of the equation are going to literally be eaten up. And I don't think we should shy away from trying to address this, even though it's a very, very difficult issue. That is my opinion. It may not be held by my colleagues sitting with me here at the table, but they let me put it on the slide, so I guess maybe they think it's okay. The accelerated habitat restoration and particularly protection of habitat to reduce long-term trends, as we've all talked about, is how important that is. And again, a good chunk of the money of that $20 million I talked about is going to go toward mitigation, which will include, I'm confident it's going to include some of the components of our habitat restoration piece, which is in the neighborhood of about $12 million. It may not get funded fully to the $12 million, but I think it's going to be close. We have a significant portion of that that goes into the Puget Sound hatchery conservation programs, including Stilly and Nooksack and Dungeness and perhaps Midhood Canal. We'll see. The co-managers need to talk further about that. And then in terms of hatchery production, there's about $5.6 million in there that's identified to increase prey base for southern resident killer whales. That needs to be coordinated with the additional funding that was provided by the legislature that's largely going into Puget Sound facilities. So I think a good piece of this will likely go into the Columbia River. So there are some, I guess my message is that there are some positive things there. We have some opportunities here in front of us if we can get this resource management plan established. It's not, no matter what it is, it's not going to be perfect. None of us are going to like it. There's going to be pieces of it that we don't like. But again, getting some certainty and security with our resource management plan, to me, is imperative to moving forward and taking full advantage of these other opportunities. Okay. Now, Mr. Grossman.
So, good morning, commissioners. All of you know that I met with you in Bellingham in executive session, and I think we went into what I would call a pretty deep dive into the legal issues insofar as the risk of litigation is concerned. There's a good reason we do that in executive session. It's entirely permitted by the Open Public Meetings Act. So I approached this part of the presentation today thinking in terms of we're now moving into a rollout phase where this resource management plan is starting to be shared with the public as it's been developed over the years. And I wanted to therefore think in terms of presenting to you at a little higher level and also with a view towards helping the citizens of the state of Washington who are concerned about this and paying attention to it with some fundamental and I think important aspects of the legal component that exists in this world here. And I would sort of summarize that as three pieces. There's a fundamental need to comply with the Endangered Species Act, and for good reason. Obviously, we have threatened species listed here. We have killer whales that are listed. And in order to continue having the department and co-managers conduct fisheries and engage in activities that have a potential impact on those listed species, there needs to be a basis to say that the Endangered Species Act requirements have been paid attention to, given careful consideration, and that plans and activities are undertaken consistent with those ESA obligations. Associated with that is litigation risk, and frankly, that really comes in two kinds of forms of risk, that if you don't have those things in place, that you will get sued, or the federal government will get sued, and you know if they get sued and they lose, then we suffer because we, in part, rely on their approvals in order to undertake the fisheries and other types of activities that the department wants to undertake and that the citizens are asking the department to undertake. But the flip side of that, too, is that even if we go ahead and do things like resource management plans, they need to be done in a robust enough way that when outside people take a look at it, they either feel confident in it, or if they're going to not feel confident and sue, which they have a proclivity to do, that the work will have been done in a manner so that we can succeed in those litigation environments as well. And I think there's another slide here that shows a little bit about what we're seeing these days in terms of litigation. It's a very, very active field out there with folks who are perhaps arguably with a somewhat narrow focus going after particular pieces because, by gosh, they're just not very happy the progress isn't being made on some very tough issues. So I think the point of this slide here is that it's not just a hypothetical. There is very, very active litigation going on, and I don't see any reason why that's going to diminish. So the challenge then is to make sure that we are thoughtful and that we have done our homework and that we develop bases through the federal government to move forward in a manner that maximizes both the biological dimension, which I think should always be the lead, but also is done in a way that if litigation comes, and maybe it's not just if, but when, the agency, the co-managers, and the federal government are best suited to say, you know, the homework has been done. Yes, we can have different points of view, but if the homework has been done, the normal standards, litigation standards, are deferential to the decision makers, so that's the key. The third legal piece, I think, is just a remembering that we don't operate in a vacuum here. The state is one of the co-managers, and you know, so we have to be coordinated with other states. We have to be coordinated with tribes. There are some legal components that exist in terms of requirements in U.S. v. Oregon and U.S. v. Washington that we have to pay attention to, and we've done that as well. Again, thinking in terms of speaking to the public, I just want to do a quick refresher about what the path forward is in terms of Endangered Species Act coverage. Really, there are three ways to go about it. You can get coverage through annual Section 7 consultations. We've been doing that for Puget Sound salmon fisheries the last couple of years because we haven't had a long-term plan in place. essentially you need a cooperative federal agency that's willing to say, yes, there's some federal agency that's engaged in an activity that creates what we call nexus for them to consult with their own implementing activities. That's been, in terms of Puget Sound Fisheries, the Bureau of Indian Affairs that says they've engaged in activity that implements co-manager fisheries, and then we've done annual consultations. Based on the 2016 experience where we had a very difficult north of Falcon, I think everyone knows pretty much what the challenge is there. We have also felt like the NEPA work that's associated with that and some of the other ESA analysis would be improved with a long-term plan. I think everybody's in general agreement that continuing with Section 7 consultations doesn't make sense. The BIA is becoming more and more reticent to do that. The federal government doesn't like it either. So it is time to move to some kind of a long-term plan. A long-term plan can be done under Section 10 of the ESA, where you do a habitat conservation plan. It can also be done with some kind of thing like a fisheries plan under what we call the 4D rules under Section 4. That's where NOAA extended the Section 9 take prohibitions to threatened salmon. They aren't there automatically. They have to be extended by rule. Once they extended those take prohibitions via Section 4 rules, they also created what was called 4D limits. This is where you can prepare some kind of a plan, submit it to NOAA, have NOAA evaluate, and if that plan is approved, you get some period of coverage. Sometimes it's indefinite for Chinook management plans. They have been either 5 or 10 year plans. But you go down that path. I would say the Section 10 process is something that we've done for some fisheries where the tribes have not been involved. Really, functionally, it's not any different than the 4D limits. In reality, the Section 7 consultations, the Section 10 planning process, they all go through the same 4D limit criteria that NOAA has come up with. So really, if you ask me, Section 4 is really where the action is in terms of the substance of what you have to do. Now, I do want to speak briefly about Section 4 a little bit here before we get to the Chinook Management Plan. Based on talking with citizens, based on talking with the staff, frankly, looking at some of the social media posts out there, there seems to be a lot of belief that the state should just get its own permit under 4D. And there is a process for doing that. It's Limit 4, I believe, and it's called a Fisheries Management Evaluation Plan. It's feasible to do that, but I think there's a lot of baggage that comes with going down that path. Number one, I think it would be a poke in the eye to co-managers. It would be a sense that we're abandoning the co-management process with tribal co-managers. That's problematic in my view. If there were a lack of interest by the co-managers, the tribal co-managers, in a joint Limit 6 RMP, I think it's something that we could consider. I think the other reason that people have thought about a go-at-your-own plan is because they viewed, well, if we run into difficult conversations with the tribal co-managers about conservation constraints and agreement on how to deal with particular management units, we can just go our own. I was intrigued by that when it was first surfaced about a year ago, but I spent a substantial amount of time investigating that and concluded it's not a valid option in terms of just trying to sidestep co-managers, if that's something that you were even willing to consider, given the poison I think it would create for the North at Falcon environment. The reality is, under the Puget Sound Salmon Management Plan, things like conservation constraints need to be jointly agreed on. And there's a process under the Puget Sound Salmon Management Plan for resolving those, and you can't just say, to heck with it, we're doing our own thing. There is an obligation under U.S. v. Washington, to come up with jointly agreed conservation constraints that are the core, I think, of parts of the resource management plan, and a process within the Puget Sound Salmon Management Plan for resolving those things. And just ignoring it and saying we're going to do our own thing because we disagree with co-managers is frankly not a legal option. So if we get to a point where there are some conservation constraints that are of concern, because these things are not easily solved. These things are not easily solved even at a technical level, let alone a policy dimension about how much risk to accept, which is, you know, kind of how you work these things out. You start with the technical folks, but then you apply a policy perspective and say, if we have a range of conservation constraints, what's the risk we're willing to accept? And that's where differing minds, you know, can come up with differing conclusions. We would if we get to some kind of an impasse, the Puget Sound Salmon Management Plan would require us to go through a dispute resolution process. And my point here, I guess, is if you're going to do that and get a resolution, if you're going to decide that's the way to go, well, then you'll have a resolution through that process, and you might as well continue on with the other way, other than a section, or excuse me, limit four FMEP, is to then just plug that dispute resolution resolved constraint into the joint limit six plan. So while it's feasible to get your own permit under 4D, it doesn't make any sense to me, and it frankly makes much more sense to do what the department has been doing since, frankly, we had that fall apart in 2016. We've been working towards a limit six resource management plan, and that's what's now being rolled out as we get very close to the end. So to sum up, you know, I think it's a science. It should be a science-first, science-driven process, with policymakers then considering the risks of various different options. If necessary, we have to use U.S. v. Washington dispute resolution processes. But long-term, you know, where you need to be to get the greatest certainty and the ability to move forward in the very difficult environment and frankly litigation likely environment that exists, is to have a long-term resource management plan approved, and that's what we're on the cusp of submitting to NOAA.
Good morning, commissioners. I'm going to start off with a graph that Phil had up on one of his earlier slides, but take a little deeper dive into it. This is hatchery and wild Chinook returns to Puget Sound from 1975 to the most recent year we have available. The upper part of the graph, and I'm going to try to point at some things on the screen to your right as I go, so hopefully people can see that. The upper part of the graph, these are the hatchery returns. So the part we're really concentrating on today are these wild returns, the light blue in the bottom of the graph. And when we look at the trend there since the 70s and 80s through the 10 years or so leading up to ESA listing, we saw an average of close to 40,000 in that period, and then the most recent 10 years, a decline down to just over 28,000. So in spite of what we've done with harvest, the exploitation rate reductions Phil showed, the habitat work, everything we've done, we've still seen that decline to the Puget Sound ESU as a whole. When we talk about ESA, we have to go down to the population level and look at the effect of fisheries on individual populations. So this is a map of Puget Sound from where we are today down here in Olympia north to the U.S.-Canada border. And there are 22 extant populations of Chinook in Puget Sound. These were identified by the technical recovery team when they did their work after listing, also identified in the Puget Sound recovery plan. And they're really the fundamental unit of diversity that we look at. There are some large populations. Skagit, Summer Falls are the largest wild population we have in Puget Sound, but there are lots of little populations, and those are can be equally important to the ESU, particularly those populations that have unique run timing or life history characteristics. As I move on, I'm going to dive into a little detail on some of these populations, and just so you'll know where those are as I move on, I'm going to talk some about the North Fork Nooksack, so farthest population to the north in Puget Sound. I'm going to talk about the Sewattle Spring population, which is the 17 on the map here. I'm going to talk about the combined north or summer and fall Stillaguamish populations, which are just south of the Skagit. I'm going to talk about the Snoqualmie population, which is, I can barely read the numbers up there, is 12 on your map, so down here in the Snohomish Basin. And finally, I'll talk about number 3 over on Hood Canal, Mid-Hood Canal. Before I get into those individual populations, I want to talk about a couple things we have to look at when we think of fisheries and these populations. So NOAA has identified critical abundance or critical level abundances for each of these populations. And that's an abundance that if the population falls down to, there's a substantial short-term risk of extirpation of that population. And that's due to things like depensatory processes, inbreeding depression, and just the ramic environmental variation we see puts those small populations at more risk if the environmental factors are less favorable. the 4D rule actually says that for a population that's in critical status or below that critical level abundance, harvest must not be allowed to appreciably increase genetic and demographic risk facing the population and must be designed to permit the population's achievement of viable function. So we've got to be really careful with harvest levels at populations as they approach these lower abundance and make sure that fisheries aren't increasing the risk to them. Phil had a great explanation for what an exploitation rate is. That's always a hard one to explain to people that aren't as familiar with fisheries. But we manage the Puget Sound Chinook populations to exploitation rate limits. The 4D rule says that the maximum exploitation rates must not appreciably reduce the likelihood of survival and recovery of the ESU. They have defined rebuilding exploitation rates for all of the populations, and those are the maximum population-specific exploitation rates that are thought to be consistent with survival and recovery. This is a super detailed risk analysis that's done to look at the effects of fisheries, hypothetical exploitation rates, and find the rate that doesn't decrease the population, the probability that population moves towards recovery, or increase the probability that it moves towards a critical level. These are kind of the basis for the management of our individual populations. Jumping back into some individual population estimates, and you'll see the variability in the status of populations as we go through these. This is Suattle Spring Chinook in the Skagit Basin. They've actually showed a positive trend since 2007, and their abundance is above that NIMS critical level. NIMS's work on rebuilding exploitation rates has said that a 32% exploitation rate is the rebuilding rate for that population, that risk assessment I was talking about. Moving back to the north, to the North Fork Nooksack Spring population, it also has a positive trend, but it's not as an encouraging positive trend because it's still bouncing around below that critical level that we want to get out of. There's some hatchery conservation programs on the Nooksack. That's a big reason for the positive trend you see here, and that will continue into the future. But that same risk analysis NIMS has done has said that a 5% rebuilding exploitation rate is the risk assessment number here. So positive trends, but very different pictures for those two. This is the aggregate of Stillaguamish summer and fall Chinook. Here we see a negative trend. Earlier 10-year average has fallen down to here in a more recent 10 years, and it's approaching that critical level that I spoke to. Also, some hatchery conservation programs here that we're depending on to try to turn this population around and rebuild it. And the NIMS rebuilding exploitation rate here was 22%. This is the Snoqualmie Fall population. There's some missing years of data here, just some data quality issues related to escapement estimates and hatchery wild compositions. But we see a negative trend over this time period. Still above the critical level, but a decline from what we saw in the past. And the NIMS rebuilding exploitation rate here is 20%. Last is Mid-Hood Canal. This is a population that's been seemingly perpetually well below the critical level. Phil spoke to the Pacific Salmon Treaty. The buy-up for that treaty called for the reinitiation of a hatchery conservation program. The previous program was not very successful and it was ended, but the co-managers are discussing how to get a new program going, what to do differently to try to get some success with that. And the NIMS rebuilding exploitation right here, also 5%. There was not enough data for NIMS to do that same risk assessment here, so they used the Nooksack analysis as a surrogate for Mid-Hood Canal. I think Mike spoke to the main purpose of the RMP, which is to get us a multi-year ESA coverage for our Puget Sound fisheries. The plan as written today would be for a 10-year period, and that would give us stable Chinook conservation objectives over that plan. I'll get into details on some of those objectives later. Those objectives are many of them tied to abundance, so higher exploitation rate allowed at better abundances, lower rate required at lower abundances, but those should be stable for a longer period. Sustainable workload is a huge one. department, tribal, DEMP staff have been working for 2 to 3 years since the last draft plan, and prior to that on that draft. A lot of work in that, but even more work goes into the annual consultations that Mike spoke to that we've been doing through the Section 7 process. A lot of requirements there that take away from other tasks like the work in the long-term plan in the past, but more importantly, things like working to restore Puget Sound Chinook in futures and fisheries for the long-term future. Just a little bit on the history of our ESA coverages for Puget Sound fisheries. Puget Sound Chinook were listed in 1999. NOAA published their 4D rule in 2000. There were a couple of short-term coverages leading up to 2004. The co-managers had submitted a plan to cover six fishery years, 2004 to 2009, that was approved by NIMS. As we moved towards the end of that plan, we began work on another plan, submitted that to NOAA. Originally, that was submitted as a five-year plan to cover 2010 to 2014 fisheries. Because of the concern with killer whales that was growing at that time, the co-managers were asked to resubmit that plan for a shorter time period, which we did. We submitted it to cover 2010 to 2013. Concurrently, NIMS, along with DFO in Canada, launched into this international expert panel process to dive deeper into the relationships between fisheries and killer whales. As that plan reached its expiration, the co-managers were also working on updating our fishery model, FRAM, as we call it. And we knew that doing that work would mean some changes to our estimates of exploitation rates on our stocks. It didn't really make sense to try to submit a long-term plan until we had finished that work and had the currency we would use for a new long-term plan. So we were in this annual consultation cycle from 2004 to 2017. In 2017, the work on that fishery model was completed. The co-managers were able to move forward with a long-term plan, which we did in December of 2017 with that submission to NOAA of a new RMP to NOAA. NOAA's initial review of that in January of 2018 concluded that that plan was insufficient. So for the 2 years since then, we've gotten another annual Section 7 incidental take permit each year, and we've been working with the co-managers and NIMS over that time to develop a revised plan that would be sufficient for resubmission. So I'll dive now into more on what's actually in the resource management plan. This is just the table of contents from the 2017 version, but the layout for the new one will be very similar. It includes sort of an introductory chapter one that's objectives, principles, some talk about relations between harvest and habitat and hatchery management. Chapter 2 gets into an overview of all of the fisheries that affect Puget Sound Chinook, which, as Phil said, is everything from southeast Alaska back through Puget Sound. Chapter 3 gets into the population structure of Puget Sound Chinook, so the 22 extant populations I talked about, and how we aggregate those for management purposes. Chapter 4 gets into the details of what our management objectives are, what are the abundance thresholds, what are the exploitation rate ceilings for each management unit. Chapter 5 gets into the implementation, how we take those management objectives, how we plan fisheries to make sure that we'll meet those objectives each year. Chapter 6 is called conservative management, and it gets into the details of how the approach we're using is conservative. It's looking at natural productivity to set these limits. Chapter 7 is details on our monitoring assessment for Puget Sound fisheries. Chapter 8 is sort of the adaptive management chapter. It's called Amendment of the Harvest Management Plan, but it gets into how might we change course if we saw something different on population productivity during the life of the plan, if we made another revision to our fishery tool that changed our estimates of exploitation rates. And then the sort of meat of the plan is Appendix A, and that's the management unit profiles, which get into the watershed by watershed, biology of the Chinook, past data, hatchery background, habitat background, and how the management objectives for each management unit were derived. This is a table of the management objectives from the plan. I don't expect you to be able to read all of this, but sort of the take-home messages are these are the 22 extant populations that were required to meet required to meet ESA requirements for. They're lumped into some management units. So like within the Nooksack River, we have North Fork and Middle Fork, as well as South Fork. We have abundance thresholds. We have an upper management threshold and a low abundance threshold. This is a higher abundance at which the populations can withstand more impact. This is what we call low abundance. We call it a critical level. It's not the same definition as NOAA's critical threshold. But when we see these abundances, it triggers more restrictive fishery measures to try to keep that population from decreasing down to a lower abundance. So I'll go into detail on a couple of these, starting with the Nooksack River. As I mentioned earlier, NOAA's rebuilding exploitation rate is 5%. Phil talked about the Pacific Salmon Treaty and the obligations we have there now on our own fisheries. The treaty will look back at this 2009 to 2015 average exploitation rate and look at it over 3 years to decide if we're meeting the obligations of the treaty. All the work in the Pacific Salmon Treaty Forum, they use a different model, the Chinook Technical Committee's fishery model. All the work to figure out what that rate will be hasn't been done. But when we've tried to do a preliminary assessment using FRAM, it comes out at around 7%. The co-manager plan proposes a 10.5% southern U.S. Exploitation rate limit on natural origin Chinook. This is actually a translation of the same objective from the prior plan, which was 7%, to the new fishery model, the new FRAM I spoke to earlier. So it's not an increase to the impact on that population. It's trying to hold that that limit the same as it was in prior plans, but using our new fishery modeling tool. This is one of the simpler examples. When you look at that graphically, the rate for southern U.S. fisheries will be held steady regardless of the abundance. We think this population is going to stay at a critical level, and we've said we're going to maintain harvest at that level throughout the life of the plan, regardless of whether the escapement level increases. There is a footnote on both of these that says one out of every 5 years we can go up to 13.5%, but 10.5% is the objective. This is just to show the past couple of years pre-season planning where we have been with Nooksack Chinook. In 2018, we had a forecast 201 natural spawners. There isn't in the plan a proposed limit on all fisheries. The only limit is on the southern U.S. fisheries. But the total limit on all fisheries, the actual projected pre-season value was 31.6% exploitation rate. The southern U.S. limit of 10.5%, and then fisheries were planned to that 10.5%. 2019, very similar picture, 242 projected spawners, and again, a 10.5% limit for southern U.S. fisheries. I'll now try to walk through one of the more complicated objectives, and that's for Stillaguamish Chinook. So again, the NOAA's RER was 22% for Stillaguamish Chinook. The co-manager proposal is to limit fisheries to that 22%, and that's all fisheries from Alaska to the southern U.S. The co-manager plan also has a limit on southern U.S. fisheries on natural origin Stillaguamish. And that's a sliding scale depending on the abundance we expect in a given year. So at lower abundances, it goes to 8% or below, and it increases up to 13% at higher abundances. Similar sort of try to assess what the PST limit obligation limit might be in FRAM is 8.6%. The co-manager proposal also has a limit to the conservation program fish from the Stillaguamish, and that too is a sliding scale. It starts at 12% at lower abundances, and then there's no limit at higher abundances. This will show how the Nooksack was a much simpler example, but it shows the step nature of this. So at run sizes predicted below 900, the co-managers will talk about what additional measures might be needed for that population. as abundance increases, it goes from an 8% and steps up to 13%. It run sizes above 1,500. Similarly, the hatchery conservation program limit starts at 12 and steps up to where there's no limit above 1,500. We've got a couple years' experience now managing Stillaguamish with these objectives. 2018 and 2019 were very different years. In 2018, we had a fairly strong forecast of 1,551. Again, the limit of on all fisheries is 22%. Preseason planning fisheries were projected to take 20.8% for natural origin. In the southern U.S., there was a limit of 13. The preseason planning projected that would be 12.2, and there was no limit on the hatchery origin from the conservation program in 2018. The projected rate was 16.5. 2019 abundance had projections fell considerably to 943. The planned all fisheries exploitation rate was projected at 18%. The limit on natural origin in the southern U.S. was 8%, and fisheries were projected, as planned, were projected to take that 8%, and the limit on hatchery origin in the SUS was 12%. Fisheries were not projected to take that full 12%. They were projected to take 10.9. So two very different years there, depending on what the abundance was projected to be for that stock. Our main remaining task as we try to complete this plan, we're still having discussions with the co-managers on Mid-Hood Canal exploitation rate limits. We need to finalize the adaptive management provisions I spoke to earlier, the language about how we would respond to changes in population productivity or to our fishery model. And as Phil said, we still have some work to do on describing fishery actions to address southern resident killer whale status. I'll mirror what he said about the council work groups. Progress, some of the modeling tools that have been developed there, I think will guide us as we try to undertake a similar task for Puget Sound. The National Marine Fisheries Service will have they've already done a lot of work. They'll have a lot of work to do once we submit a plan as they go through three separate but concurrent processes that they need to complete. The most time-consuming calendar-wise will be the environmental impact statement, which they think will take them about 15 months. That process will include a substantial public comment period on their draft environmental impact statement. They will complete a 4D rule determination that will take 12 months. There will also be a 30-day public comment period on their proposed evaluation and pending determination once that's completed. And they will create a biological opinion that they project will take about 7 months. Again, the EIS, Environmental Impact Statement, is the most time-consuming at 15 months, but when you look at the calendar, if a plan was submitted by the 1st of February, they believe they could have their work done by the 1st of May in 2021, which is sort of the beginning of the 2021 fishing year. We have been and will be doing work to communicate this plan. Obviously, today's presentation to you and the public is a key one. We'll be planning to hold some additional public meetings as we move into February. We've tried to keep stakeholders and advisor groups updated as we've worked over the past couple years. There hasn't always been a lot of news to report, but we've tried to keep them up to speed on what we had gotten done and what the timelines for completing and submitting a plan might be. We're planning to try to give a presentation to the Salmon Recovery Council in March, and we will have a lot of information on the web page on the plan. As soon as we have a version to share, we will. There will be a sign-up for people that want to be notified by email as different pieces of what we're doing and what NIMPS is doing are completed. With that, I'm going to hand it back to Phil to take us home.
Thanks, Kyle. I'm not sure I'm going to take us home to a place we want to be, but there's just a couple of concluding thoughts here. Remember the 2017 plan that nobody liked? Well, neither did NIMS. They said it was insufficient. meaning that that plan would not have got us to a point where we had a no jeopardy opinion and we had a permit to allow our fisheries to continue. So all of the work that the co-managers and Kyle has been referencing since that time has been closely coordinated with National Marine Fisheries Service so that we can avoid that happening again. I can't say with total certainty that will be the outcome, but I can say with certainty that because of the close coordination and the review of the various components of the plan that NOAA has done as we've gone mm-hmm. along, puts us in a better place. There's a lot not to like. It's scary stuff because there's a lot of these exploitation rates that are very low in response to the status of the stock. We're going to have to take advantage of some of the opportunities that we have to look for ways to continue to be innovative to get us access to those hatchery fish that were on that chart that both Kyle and I showed you. But I hope we have impressed at least upon you that continuing to go on a year-by-year basis is not a strategy for success. You have a risk of litigation every year. You have increased uncertainty in non-treaty fisheries because you don't have a set of known conservation objectives. NOAA gives us every year what they call a guidance letter just prior to the North Falcon process that has those conservation objectives in them. If those are changing from year to year, it makes it much more difficult for us, for the department, for the co-managers. I also hope that what Mike had to say about going it alone versus working together and having a plan that is developed with the co-managers and implemented through our North of Falcon process, that the importance of maintaining that tribal state partnership in the endeavor of crafting our fisheries and responding to conservation issues of our resources is an important outcome. I don't want to overstate the last bullet, the stabilized annual North of Falcon process. This is not to suggest that everything's all of a sudden hardwired and there's no hard discussions to have and allocations are settled and how you're going to split up what impacts you have on wild fish are going to be done. It doesn't do that, but it does provide us a solid base from which to start, one that we don't have now. I mentioned that we go ahead. I mentioned that we have some opportunities to try and go about reversing the trend and making things better in the long run, even with the adoption of this RMP. I mentioned that we have a 10-year agreement with Canada and Alaska in terms of further reducing interceptions in their fisheries on the stocks of concern. We have some substantial new funding that's going to be made available for habitat restoration, for hatchery conservation programs, for increased hatchery production to respond to assist with the southern resident killer whale prey base. And there is some additional money that I believe will come to the department from that $20 million that I mentioned. I don't know exactly how much yet. We currently get about $2.2 million, so it'll be something in addition to that. And all of those things it's not going to double it or anything. Don't get carried away. But there could be a little bit of additional money as well for the department to do their work relative to salmon and their interactions with the Pacific Salmon Commission. But I will leave you with this. I have observed throughout my career when things work and when you find success and when you don't. And if people are fighting amongst themselves what relative to some of the intricacies, I'll call them, which may be an understatement from their perspective on issues, and we aren't together when it comes to looking for major increases in funding to supplement the types of activities and put us in a different, in a better place, the opportunity for us to be successful there is significantly diminished if we're not together. The only reason, in my mind, that we were able to get the additional $20 million was because the tribes and the state were together, including Alaska. And the only way that we're going to be able to not have this a one-time thing, the only way, in my mind, that you're going to continue to get that kind of support from the legislature for hatchery production is if we're together, everybody. The department, thank you, the director, for allowing me to be a part of the process. Looking forward to getting this RMP submitted to NOAA. That doesn't mean it will automatically be accepted, every piece of it. There may be some additional discussions that will need to take place, but it's time to move forward, in my judgment, with submission of the RMP and begin looking under this new paradigm how we can go about making things better and have a future for our fisheries.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. All of you, each of you. Any questions from the commission? Commissioner Thorburn.
Most of the insufficiency determination in the 2017 plan dealt with Appendix A. Is that correct? The various biologic plans? Am I correct?
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Carpenter. Commissioner, I think that's a fair assessment. It was a lot of the issues were in the individual watershed sections of the RMP.
Commissioner McIsaac.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And let me start by saying thanks to these gentlemen for all the hard work, particularly thanks to Mr. Phil Anderson, who might be one of the hardest working people of all time, really, when you think about what he's doing as the chair of the council and Pacific Salmon Treaty and all the rest of it. So the help from Phil is greatly appreciated, and all the good legal work from Mr. Grossman and, of course, Ron Warren and Kyle Addix have worked very hard on this. January of 2018, when the commission took this up, not only was NIMS not happy with it, a lot of people weren't. And we talked about various things at that time, including consulting with the commission. You've got that as your first slide, and so you've been doing some of that. Mr. Grossman alluded to that in December, and this is apparently another consultation here. A question now, and then after public testimony, Mr. Chairman, maybe we ought to talk about what kind of support we can give as a commission to what's being proposed here. But on one of your slides on Nooksack, you noted the conservation hatchery benefit. Then the next slide had to do with Stella Guamish and the conservation hatchery. So back in January of 2018, one of the things that we asked you all to go back and talk to the tribes about was a conservation hatchery on the Stella Guamish, because it looked like the natural fish weren't even replacing themselves. The hatchery fish were, and it seemed to make more sense to put some more effort into that. And I know Mr. Warren spent quite a bit of time on that. But I wondered if you could just answer whether or not there is any of that in the same vein as Nooksack or anything more, and if there's not, why, what the reasons are, and if there's any of that that might be coming in the future.
Chair Carpenter, Commissioner McIsaac, thank you. as we came to tentative agreement with the Stella Guamish tribe on the management unit profile, there were numerous issues that had been topics of discussion throughout the negotiations, throughout the conversations, and all the hard work that staff had done. Those items, trying to, my word, streamline or help assist in how we look at and proceed through processes relative to habitat restoration, looking at continued look at what we do for hatchery operations to make sure that we've got the best chance doing the things the best we can. Those items remain on a list of things that we plan to get back together as soon as North Falcon's done, assuming that the plan is submitted to continue to finalize. And I'd back up. I'd say even if we don't submit the plan, if we don't come to a conclusion or there's some issue with the plan, that there's a strong commitment between the state and the tribe to continue those conversations so that we can assure ourselves that we turn a page and take advantage of some of the things that we've talked about that we know will benefit situations into the future and put those in place so that we are taking advantage of them in the future.
Anything else?
Could I
have Phil, please.
So I was part of the discussions with the Stillaguamish tribe, and I want to acknowledge that Chairman John Yannity, I think he's still back there, and we had an opportunity to talk a lot about both the issues associated with the habitat, as Ron said, habitat protection, restoration, looking at potential projects, permitting, increasing permitting, Director Sisowund and Deputy Director Windrope have talked specifically along with Jeff Davis about the habitat and permitting pieces. But we had a lot of discussions about the conservation hatchery program. And I think it's he'll correct me if I'm wrong, that be Chairman Yannity, but there was a definite commitment on the part of the Stillaguamish tribe to continue those discussions. We did not, because we were focused on the MUP and updating the MUP, we did not have an opportunity and we didn't have time to complete those conversations. But I think, as Ron indicated, that there's a willingness on the part of the tribe to continue. I think there's a commitment to continue having those conversations because there's a lot to talk about. Those fish are extremely important to that system because, as you say, the natural origin fish are not replacing themselves. So we just want to be really careful if we're going to make changes in that program. That we're doing it for the benefit of the spawning population, and so talking about how to go about doing that is what I think there's a commitment to continue to do.
Okay. Sean, do you have anything you want to add? He's waving back. For those of you who don't know, this is Chairman Sean Yannity from Stillaguamish.
Good morning, everybody. I didn't plan on speaking, but I came here just in case there was questions or any concerns. I want to thank your staff for some very tough discussions we had for 2 years over the plan and the issues with our fish. We've got opportunities for habitat restoration inside the Stillaguamish that most watersheds don't have, and that's something our tribe's trying to take advantage of. We've got over 1,000 acres of land that's set aside and for protection for treaty resources, whether it's elk or salmon or other wildlife. We've got another 450 acres that'll be coming online at the mouth of the river here within the next couple months. And we've got probably another 400 or 500 acres upriver that we're looking at to help with flood control. It's one of the big factors that have an impact to our salmon. And this year we're seeing, you know, a very low, less than 400 of our natural origin coming back, but almost 600 of our hatchery fish returning. And that was, and we're seeing a lot of that. And we're only taking 25% of the fish off the river for broodstock. So when our hatchery returns are coming back stronger than the natural origin, that's what spurred the conversations with your staff on our concern about the limiting the impacts to hatchery catch. And so for us, every fish that comes back to the spawning ground is important. Of course, that phrase has got me in trouble because we've been asked, and if that's the case, so every fish comes back to the river, why aren't we pulling our nets? It's the only place we can fish. There's no way that we're going to be able to get out and get out in the salt water without causing court cases with our relative tribes. We choose not to fish Port Susan because of the mixed stock fisheries with the Snohomish fish. And instead of getting into allocation discussions there, we stick inside the river. Our allocation last year was only 15 fish for our whole tribe. And each year we face those scenarios. I think it was about 10 years ago, I went back to our council and said, we're taking back our allocation. Because as most of you know, back in the mid-80s, my Uncle Lou, who was chairman and fisheries manager back then, closed our fishery down. Subsistence and ceremonial. And that was picked up by the co-managers. Because any unused resource in the treaty or any unused share that by the co-manager goes back to the pot for everybody to pick up. So for 30 years, we weren't fishing, but everybody else was catching our share. We decided to take our share back in exercising our ceremony for the salmon. And so that's what we do, is we catch just a handful of fish for our salmon ceremony and then get our youth out there and try to hang on to our culture. So a lot of those discussions, you know, your staff got an earful of our way of life and our perspective. And one topic that we want to continue is hatcheries. At some point, NOAA's going to have to be in the conversations because since our, you know, is NOAA's view, they don't want to see hatchery runs being larger than your natural origin when you're trying to rebuild a stock. And that's exactly what's happening with ours. At some point, we've got to move NOAA and get some help on what we're all going to do. Otherwise, we're all going to be losing out on Stilly Chinook. And that's not a place that we want to be because extinction is not an option for us. And we can't do a hatchery that's going to produce fish for harvest because it doesn't do anything for the Stillaguamish tribe. Since we can't catch those fish out in the salt water, we take on all the regulatory burden and financial costs for no benefit. And impacts to our fish. So at some point, you know, those conversations really have to come down the road on how we're going to do that. But for the record, we want to recover these fish, and not just for the fact that we're hoping to regain our culture and maintain it. We're hanging on by a thread, but we want to be able to have a commercial fishery on Stillaguamish Chinook at the same time that we see our friends out there throwing a line in trying to catch a Chinook salmon as well. So if there's any other questions, I'll be more than happy to answer.
Sean, thank you. Appreciate you coming forward. Appreciate you coming down. And okay, before we go on to open public comment, if there's not any other discussions, I just want to reiterate the four gentlemen at the table, I want to thank all of them, but I have a longstanding working relationship in this arena with Phil Anderson, and I served on the Southern Panel Pacific Salmon Commission. And to kind of add on to what Commissioner McIsaac said, I don't know if there's a harder working guy in this arena. I don't know how his wife keeps up with suitcase A, suitcase B, suitcase C, and, oh, I got to go put this laundry over in this dryer to keep him on the road to and from everywhere. So, Phil, it's been a pleasure. Hope we can keep doing this for a while, and thank you very much. We are now going to go to open public comment, and we have four people. I would ask the four of you, if you would, come up together. We have four chairs, two mics. We'll make this work. All of you know the protocol, 3 minutes, and so on. Norm Reinhardt, George Harris, Ron Garner, and Pat Patillo. Another stellar group of four individuals.
Well, that's pretty shaky.
That's pretty sad.
Yeah. Norm, you have first swing at the ball here.
I'm the rookie here, and I'm talking from sentiment. First, I would like to thank the Stillaguamish Tribal Chair for his honesty, for coming here and telling their side. It is important for me to know so that I can transmit that to my fellow recreationalists that we're not the only ones being asked to sacrifice. Speaking of sacrifice, what I heard here today concerns me. It concerns me in that we may be looking at some very, very tough choices. Not just within the recreational fleet, but within the commercial fleet. And not only just the commercial net fleet, but the commercial guide fleet. That we all may be tasked to shoulder the responsibility of what we so often come up here and talk about. And that is the importance of our wild fish. The importance of our hatchery fish, the importance of having those fish out there, but the huge challenges those fish are facing. We can produce 10 times the amount of fish that we are now. We could do that, but are they going to survive? What's going to happen to them when they reach Puget Sound? And once they get out of Puget Sound, they reach an ocean that's becoming what apparently is more hostile to their survival. We have a lot of challenges, and it's going to potentially take some sacrifice. I would like to thank the department for the hard work that they're doing. I'd like to thank my fellow sporting organizations for the hard work that they're doing. But perhaps it's time to reinstitute a statewide recreational committee for us to sit down and discuss these hard issues, because it isn't going to be as easy as we'd like. Thank you.
Thank you, Norm. George?
Thank you, Chair Carpenter, members of the Commission, Director Susawin. I'd like to provide some comments on the Puget Sound Chinook Harvest Management Plan this morning. My name is George Harris, and I'm president of the Northwest Marine Trade Association. Our members provide the boats, supplies, and service that allow Washingtonians to thoroughly enjoy and use their WDFW fishing licenses. I currently serve on the WDFW Budget Policy and Advisory Group and served on Governor Inslee's Southern Resident Killer Whale Task Force. I have serious concerns about the management plan's impact on WDFW's already well-managed marked selective fisheries in Puget Sound. In my December 2017 letter to the Commission, I wrote, "The plan will devastate marked selective fishing in Puget Sound for the next 10 years. In my April 2019 letter, I wrote, "The plan puts WDFW's 20-year investment in Puget Sound marked selective fisheries in serious jeopardy." I think it is important to be clear what marked selective fishing is. In Puget Sound, it's the release of all wild Chinook and requires the use of barbless hooks. It is the conservation of our ESA wild stocks. Recreational anglers are the only user group that fishes selectively. It has worked. It's been successful for 20 years to conserve and protect our wild Chinook.
Recently, I met with Director Suswin, former Director Anderson, and other senior WDFW staff, and one topic we all agreed on was that further sport fishing reductions in Puget Sound will not improve the recovery of our wild Chinook. Puget Sound recreational fisheries are managed very conservatively and have been cut steadily for the past 30 years. My number one concern with the plan is the requirement for adipose fin clipping, mass marking of Stillaguamish hatchery-produced conservation Chinook. This is not required by NOAA, and I believe it handcuffs WDFW in its management of our marked selective fisheries, which are vital to the member businesses I represent and WDFW license holders. I think the Commission needs to remember the strong headwinds this plan created for WDFW in 2017 and 2018 as we head into the legislative session. I urge WDFW to remove the requirement of mass marking Stillaguamish Conservation Chinook from the plan and protect the future of Puget Sound marked selective fishing. Thank you very much.
Thank you, George. Ron Gardner.
Thank you, Director, Deputy Director, and Commissioners today. And then one of the things that doesn't get said enough is thank you to the staff of WDFW. A couple years ago, we were in back in this same situation. Things weren't going well. And I guess I should announce, I'm president of the Puget Sound Anglers State Board, 16 chapters statewide. I'm on the Billy Frank Jr. Coalition, Orca Task Force member, Northern Tribes Coalition, and the WDFW Budget Advisory Group. There's not a lot of time to talk about this, but the 10-year plan is frightening. Three things that we see not happening is you should have one of these right here in front of you. I had these sent out, given to all of you. 85% of the habitat is lost for wild fish, to be able to produce wild fish, the tidelands. Salish Sea, 85.2%. Skagit Bay, 82.6%. The other thing is blaming fishing, thanks, Norm, is not going to fix this. We keep cutting and cutting and cutting fishing. This 10-year plan does nothing but cut more harvest. We haven't dealt with predation, and we have not dealt with hatchery production other than a one-year fix. It's going to go away, and it's going to go away on our watch. In 1983, we had this same scenario that was worse. What's the difference? We had probably another 160 million fish in the system, and we had probably 8,000 pinnipeds or harbor seals back then as opposed to 80,000 in the Salish Sea today. We don't have the coverage for these wild fish anymore the way the predation's going. They're getting eaten up and wiped out on the way out of the river, and they're getting taken out by seals, sea lions, and orcas on the way up. And we are only taking 1/6. The pinnipeds are taking 6 times more than the fishermen, and this is just not an acceptable solution. Nobody's done anything but restrict harvest and fishing. We got to go back and fix this. I mean, you look at the Stilly, and Sean and I became good friends, and which I'm thankful for over this, trying to come up with solutions to fix that river. That's the worst river we have to deal with. Solutions need to be had. We've gone and dealt with him. Maybe we need to help him with some spawning channels. They want naturally spawning fish. Mid-Hood Canal, we can fix. That is a joke. We are trying to take a Chum River and make it a Chinook producer on its own. It's been happening for 10 years, and it's failed. The program is gone. Are we going to go and work with the tribes and go to NOAA, and are we going to push back and say enough is enough? We need predation control, and we need hatchery production increases, not just for 1 year, but for many years coming forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Ron. Pat, I must say, it's nice to see you at the table again.
Oh, yeah, it's a lovely Saturday morning for you all, huh? And thank you for allowing me to provide some public comment. I did actually write something, and I think there might have been copies of that provided, but I very much appreciated the presentation by the department and Phil Anderson and Mike Grossman. And so I'm not going to cover a lot of ground. I think they did a good job of providing what, well, you know, just for those who don't know, I am a former employee of WDF and WDFW, and spent a career managing these fisheries. I also was fortunate enough to be involved in the co-writing of a co-manager management plan for Puget Sound Chinook, the original one, right at the time of listing. And I'm proud of that and proud of the work that we did together. A lot of the people that I worked with at that time are gone. There are some great folks there that we did a lot of good work around 2000 to put together that initial plan. That plan with the exploitation rates, the very fundamental change, it was a robust plan, and it was a success. It was a great success. It was responsive to the changing status of Chinook and Puget Sound. So I'm proud of that, and the fact that it is a success is borne out by the history, some of the information that Phil mentioned. While the Puget Sound Chinook populations have declined on average, the calculation that I use is by 13%. Some are actually up and some are down. But the impact of the fisheries managed by WDFW, the non-Indian fisheries, on those populations have been reduced by as much as 80% since the period just prior to ESA listing. So the co-managers really have been successful at achieving the intention of the plan, and that is to ensure that fishing does not impede recovery. So I endorse all the comments about the importance of habitat, addressing those issues. The co-managers consistently have argued that recovery over wild populations will not be possible through management of fisheries alone, without the protection and restoration of habitat and a functional ecosystem. So, despite that agreement, regarding the inability to improve the status of Puget Sound Chinook populations like Stillaguamish by constraining fisheries alone, this new plan adds new but I think unnecessary fishing controls. And just if I might just quickly mention those, I think they are the Stillaguamish wild exploitation rate of 8%, the Stillaguamish mass marked hatchery limit of 12%, and also, it hasn't been discussed, but this Lake Washington, Green River, and Puyallup River limiting pre-terminal fisheries to 12 or 13%. I think that's going to be problematic in the future. And I think add that to the perennial weak stock champion, most constraining stock champion, Mid-Hood Canal. We've got a very, very tough future in order for you to, in providing, especially the department, in providing meaningful recreational fishing opportunity. I heard from Phil and even from Sean Yannity a willingness to continue to work on those issues, including Midwood Canal. It doesn't mean that for the next 10 years of this plan that that's over with and we have to live by it. We could see ways of changing that. I'm always optimistic. That's why I guess that's my passion for the fisheries and the resource that keeps me involved. So I really do support and argue that a new plan is important. And replacing the process since 2013 of the 1 year at a time, it can't work. And I think it's one of the reasons, a very major reason, why the co-managers have struggled at North of Falcon. I tend to think North of Falcon's been a bit dysfunctional in the last few years. And this unequal treatment of permitting is definitely contributing to that dysfunction. So a new plan should make a new sort of level the playing field for the North of Falcon process, and that's what I have my focus on. We've got to improve the public involvement in the North of Falcon process, and It's not going to improve unless the co-managers improve their functionality in that process. So I note the comments that Mike Grossman made relative to adhering to the Puget Sound Salmon Management Plan. I think that's very important, including the use of provisions for dispute resolution. Those will help, and you've got to get back to that, and the only way to do that is to move forward with permitting for a new plan. Thank you very much.
Pat, all four of you, thank you very much for your comments. Much appreciated. Commissioner McIsaac.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wondered if the staff could turn to slide 29, which is the remaining tasks that have yet to be done. I wanted to make a comment of relative to endorsing all or parts of this plan and why, and then something to suggest to the commission that would be included in the submission to NOAA, or after talking to the co-managers to see if they might go along with it. So, and let me also say, during public testimony, you heard Mr. Harris talk about the 12%. I have heard during our consultations some reasons why a 12% limit on the open ocean anadromous Stiligwamish stock does not mean a 12% limit on all of the other Puget Sound stocks, and to whatever extent that becomes a limiting thing, closing the selective fisheries and the sport fishery inside Puget Sound, that it's not the same number. And as the outreach program goes forward, I would hope that all of those things that you all have worked on gets told to them. And I think that in general that it's time for us to update our conservation goals, whether or not we had to do so for reducing litigation risk or not. It's a good thing to do, to take a look at those and update those. I think it's very important, the points that have been made here about reducing the litigation risks with regard to fishery stability. That's one of the mandates of the commission in terms of our RCWs, is to try to manage for stable fisheries. And they've made some excellent points here that we are in a very risky environment that could end up closing fisheries for procedural reasons, and that would be bad news. On these remaining things yet to do, resolving Mid-Hood Canal exploitation rate limits, I think Mr. Grossman spoke to not going it alone, but some way of putting both of those, where we're at on that and where the tribes are at, into a co-manager agreement, and sending that to NIMS to see if they would both pass the no jeopardy evaluation. And if that's possible, I think that might be a way to move forward. And if not, then the dispute resolution that was spoken about being inside the plan and not a hold up to this would be a good way to go. The adaptive management provisions, I'm glad to see that's in there, because there can be surprises, and they can even be surprises in the positive direction. It has happened before, and so that's a good thing to have there. I think what I heard on the southern resident killer whale status was that including more fishery actions for the purpose of helping the killer whales, some people would say, well, wait a minute, that's a scary thing. Are there more closures coming on just for that we haven't heard about? That's not part of the salmon conservation package. But I think what we heard was that there's a pretty good evaluation term in there. And if it's really true that 100 fish that swim past Nia Bay headed for Puget Sound, that virtually all of them, or most all of them, or over 95% of them, are exposed to killer whales before they're caught because of all the closures and because of all the terminal nature of most of the fishing in Puget Sound, that I would hope that in our delegation to you, if that's not true, that there are major fishery actions, reductions that would be out there that we haven't heard of yet just for this purpose, that we would get consulted on that. But what I took from the modeling was that maybe that's not the case. So in terms of submitting this plan after the co-manager agreement is all done, I wanted to get back to the predation and pinniped point that Mr. Anderson spoke to on slide 8. And he took the time to put that bullet in there and make note of it being a significant thing. So we're going to be submitting something that basically is our conservation goals for salmon. But I would suggest if there's a way in that letter to the National Marine Fisheries Service giving the plan to them, that mention could be made of the predation and particularly pinnipeds, but also birds, but in particular pinnipeds, be noted in the letter. And if there's some way of opening the door for some more protection from pinnipeds, we have a salmon predation pinniped policy that this commission has adopted. It's an important issue. It was brought up in public testimony. And if there's a way to get that in the submittal letter, as please start something on that, that would be a good thing. The other thing, and it was also mentioned in public testimony, is if we could request some sort of biological review of this Mid-Hood Canal situation that has, as I understand it, a cloudy genetic background, to say the least. So those are my suggestions for the commission to consider.
Commissioner Thorburn?
I also wanted to make mention of the predator control. Phil said do something about it. And that's kind of what we keep hearing, do something about it. I was kind of sort of recognized as someone perhaps who is against predator control, particularly lethal predator control. Absolutely not. And when we're dealing with any species population that's at critically threatened levels, predator control is an essential part of management. Including lethal predator control. The problem is, what do you do and how do you do it? It's extremely challenging. I deal with some terrestrial species in critical shape. We do predator control, including birds. We take out birds. How effective it is when these predators are here because of human activities, they expand into areas because of human activities, and Homo sapiens, folks, is becoming one of the most prevalent species on this planet. And we need to do the science to understand how predators are reacting to these human activities and will react to our predator control activities to be effective. And so it's not so easy. I think that's why, Phil, you said do something about it, because what is it that we do about it? Lethal control is a piece of it, but we need to, we talked about pinnipeds and the food web. We need to understand what lethal control of pinnipeds is going to do to this very complex system before just going out and trying to kill all the pinnipeds. So I want people to understand that I am in no way against predator control. It has to be an essential part of protecting any threatened population. It's just how to do it that is extremely complex.
Anyone else? Phil, go ahead.
I think, thank you, Chairman Carpenter. Commissioner McIsaac made mention of the southern resident killer whale and characterized what he heard from us, maybe from me. And I don't want to overstate or provide unwarranted comfort that everything's going to be fine with a biological opinion on our salmon fisheries, be it in the ocean or in Puget Sound. we have a ways to go. The analytical work, however, that we have done in the Civic Council work group process, I think, especially with the participation actually in the direction of from Kyle and Derek from WDFW, is going to be very helpful in assuring that we have a science-based approach to evaluating the effect of fisheries on prey base. And that, in my mind, is what has been missing so far, is there's a knee-jerk reaction to jump to a conclusion about cutting a fishery having a positive effect on the ability of southern resident killer whales to have enough food to eat. And that's, so I just wanted to clarify that a little bit. And on the predation piece, I had no idea where you were or weren't, Commissioner Thornburg. But there are different ways, there are different strategies that have been discussed. They don't all, as you say, involve lethal removal, but if you have them staging in a place where that our salmonids, be it steelhead or salmon, are easy prey, and we could even disrupt that behavior, I think we need to start looking at some of those things. And I think about what's going on with our Puget Sound steelhead in particular, as being an example of that. So I'm an advocate of let's take a hard look at it. I know people have been looking at it, but let's not shy away at it from it because it's difficult.
Well, I think I have a closing statement that's very brief. I really appreciate all the comments, and the presentation I thought was really, really helpful. I was taken by the last four individuals that spoke under open public comment, Ron and Norm and Pat and George. And I know there's a lot of other folks out there that are very passionate and have a lot of energy and devotion to working towards rebuilding these stocks of concern, continuing their lifestyle, keeping the businesses going forward. I don't know, Ron or Director, I know you have meetings with what we call the coalition, but I would hope as we move forward with this new oversight and involvement in the new 10-year plan, that we could involve some of these people that have a significant vested interest in the future, and help contribute towards making this as successful and painless as possible. And Sean, I hope and believe that we can continue to work closely together in your basin and others to move the ball down the field, not just put the ball on the field, move the ball down the field. And any suggestions that come forward from you or other tribal folks that they would want to share with us, we want to learn, because where we are now is not a place we want to be. We got to go forward. So that's all I have to say. Okay. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Okay.